Hello and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm yours, Sam Vecini. We're presented by The Athletic. Today on the show, Robbie Calland is in the building. We're going to have a good time. We wanted to talk about the Hawks a lot on this podcast. And look, it's important to talk about basketball. This is ostensibly a basketball podcast.
In theory.
But like, I'll be honest, really the reason I had Robbie on was to talk about like Fast and Furious 9. I know that Robbie night,
in lieu of game two, I saw it and then I was like, oh, I'll catch up on the game. And it was, I only had to catch up on one half of basketball because it was all that mattered. It was great.
Yeah.
The saved me like an hour.
Yeah. And I'll introduce him. It's the father of Uproxx Sports. It's Robbie Calland, just an absolute legend of the Game Theory Podcast. Robbie, it's good to have you here. How's it going?
It's great to be here. I'm doing fantastic. I got to get back with the family last night in the theater. You know, I mean, you can't ask for more. I mean, we'll get into it more, but it was a lovely experience, first theater experience in 17 months or something. Couldn't have asked for anything more, you know.
No. Let's talk playoffs first. I want to be able to give full spoiler warnings for people here.
Yeah, for sure.
We're definitely going to talk quite a bit about what happened in this Fast and Furious movie.
I was just saying the basketball has been terrific. So, like, work-wise, it's been lovely. You know, like, there are some years where the first round's not a lot of fun to work. You know this.
Yeah,
it's there are years where there's, like, one or two good series, and then we're just slogging through the rest. And I feel like we had probably five legitimately fun series, even if they didn't go the distance in round one. And round two was good as well.
Yeah.
So, I can't complain about the basketball so far, which is odd given how many people have been out.
Yeah, and given just the level of complaints that people have had about just like, oh my God, the ratings, they're going to be terrible. Oh my God, there are no stars in the playoffs. And they've been amazing, actually. Like, the ratings, are here.
And the thing about that is, everybody, the same people that complain about the ratings complain that the NBA doesn't do a good job marketing new stars, and I'm like, do you know how you market new stars to people who watch the game casually? Have them in big, important games. Yeah. It's the only way it works. People don't care, like, because guess what? Devin Booker's been a guy that people know who he is for a while. But what was the complaint about Devin Booker? Empty stats. What's been the complaint about Trae Young? Empty stats. Well, now they're in big games. Now we get to see them doing it and winning, and that's how you build stars.
Yeah.
So, if like, you can't complain about the same two things that conflict with each other.
Yeah.
You don't get to do it.
Like, I mentioned this on the last podcast with James. Like, you can't complain. Well, first and foremost, if the NBA can't make a star out of Trae Young, it will have miserably failed.
Yes.
Like, that motherfucker's taking bows in MSG. That dude is shimmying on the court. Like, what are we doing here? Right?
Yeah.
Like, if you can't make a star, if you can't make a villain out of that guy for everyone else and a superstar for Atlanta fans out of Trae Young, I mean, come on, guys. Like, what are we doing here? He's throwing off the backboard passes. Like, he's making shit as fun as humanly possible within basketball. But yeah, like, 100%. I think people like seeing new things. I think that there's a reason that TV shows don't go on for 95 seasons.
Right.
It's because they get stale. I think sometimes the NBA, for the casual fan, can feel like it's getting a little bit stale.
Yeah.
And even though these people that are casual fans love basketball, they also get bored by the same teams winning.
Product. I mean, like, most people view the NBA like their favorite TV show, like you said. So if you feel like you've seen this episode before, you're probably not tuning in.
Right.
Until the very end, because, you know, you might want to check out the finals. But, you know, you can't complain that there's no parity, and then when there's parity, say, well, this is bad for the league.
Yeah.
And it's like, this is where it starts. This is where you start getting the chance to talk about these other teams as legit contenders, because what happens so often is we talk, oh, like, this is a new fun team, and then they get shit on by LeBron, and everybody goes, oh, they were frauds.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Like, think about the Raptors before the Raptors made their title run. that's what that was the Raptors' issue. Is everybody was like, oh, like regular season team, and so we have these designations of 82 game teams versus 16 game teams, and the same with players, and it's just good to see some fresh faces showing up in that 16 game conversation, and I think it's been great, and it obviously helps that the basketball's been good.
The basketball's been great.
We have game two of that Sun series. Outrageous. Even if it took an hour to play the last 3 minutes. Outrageous stuff. Even game one of that series. Game one of the Hawks-Bucks series was so much fun. Every game in that Hawks-Sixers series was wild as hell. Because you at some point you were like, well, it doesn't matter what the Sixers are up by. They're going to lose this game. Let's find out how. It was great. It was delightful. And like you said, like it's not just that we have new teams, it's that we have new faces showing up that are like playing their roles.
Yeah.
Devin Booker is a hero. He's not a villain. I think he wasn't sure what he was supposed to be for a while.
Yeah.
You know, and some of these young guys have that, and Trae Young I think was the same way. He didn't embrace the villain stuff until this year in full.
Yeah.
And it can be hard, and like I understand it. It can be hard to do. It can be hard to embrace the fact that 90% of NBA fans are going to hate you. Like, it can be really, like, to think that people are just going to want you to fail. But to learn how to revel in that and to learn how to just make them at least respect you.
Yep.
I've loved seeing that from Trae. Because, look, like, it has not been a secret that I have never been a big Trae guy.
And for people who don't know, like, Robbie covered Trae for a year, right, in Atlanta. Before we moved to
I was out.
You were out?
I was gone by then. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I was gone for Trae's first year. I was Robbie at that covered draft and then I moved.
Yeah, Robbie covered the Hawks for a long time in Atlanta. And then
7 years.
Robbie also lives in Phoenix or lives in Flagstaff and occasionally goes in and covers the Phoenix Suns. So I thought Robbie was going to be kind of the perfect person to have on this podcast, and he is because he's covered two of these very, prevalent teams in the NBA right now, and arguably the two biggest stories I think in the NBA right now. Like, I think the Bucks are going to win this series. I think that the Suns probably win the series, but the Clippers are at least going to make it competitive.
It's going to be 6 or 7 for sure.
Yeah. But you have been around both of these incredibly important teams in the construct. So continue on, Trae. I just wanted to contextualize it for people who don't listen to the episodes with you.
Yeah. So, the thing with Trae is, like, I wasn't sure how to translate. He has proven me and a billion other people wrong, right? That's not a secret. And my thing is, like, look, like, at this point, if you don't believe in Trae and what he can do on the basketball court, like, then you're legitimately just not watching at this point. Like, there are still flaws in the game, but what he does is so great. Like, I was, like, when he was – and look, like, it's not – I'm not a draft guy. So, I was coming in having watched Trae at Oklahoma in the ESPN games that he was on often.
all of them.
And all of them. So, I Trae was one of the guys I felt like I'd seen a lot, and I was like, well, like, the dude chucks. Like, he wasn't a great finisher at the rim, so I was like, is he going to be able to do that in the NBA, that sort of thing? But look, the man has made the floater his kingdom. And that's such a, like, he saw, like, the thing that I think is really important about Trae and his development is he knows what he's not great at, and he finds ways to either just, like, make it not matter or find ways to bolster everything around it. So, like, he's not the best finisher at the rim, but he's gotten better at it. And two, it doesn't matter because he doesn't want to get to the rim, and it throws everybody off.
Right.
It's like him and Ja and this new wave of guys who realize, like, I don't have to get layups. Like, I'm going to be a 53% guy from the floater range.
Right.
And, like, at some point, you just have to say, like, that's a good shot. Like, it was one of those things for years. Like, well, if you make a guy shoot that, like, that's, good job. If he makes it, you tip your hat. But this time, you have to try to find a way to take that away. And he couples that with just he can shoot. The floater and the lobs look the exact same, and I'm still not sure how Capella and Collins know. There must be some eye thing. But, like, he shoots these things, and I'm like, how has there never been a basket interference on one of these guys?
Yeah.
Because, like, I would be like, shit, I don't know. Like, this lob, question mark, and like go grab one that's above the rim. but like he's so crafty with that, and I'm interested to see how he goes forward now that there's going to be some rule changes on the stop start stuff and the jumping in the guys and stepping backwards, and that's going to take some things away, but he'll adapt. Like he made the way it plays now as advantageous to him as possible.
I'm going to be honest. I think it's going to be really, really hard for them to litigate that, because a lot of what happens with him is very,
they run into him.
It's very obvious contact.
Yeah.
Like it's not like some of these dudes like kicking out their feet on three pointers where it's very
MPJ is going to get so many offensive fouls. Yeah. With his 3-point shot, because like he kind of naturally does that. And then he's the only guy I've seen get called for multiple kickouts this year, MPJ.
Yeah.
And it's because whenever he does exaggerate, his natural motion does kind of split his legs. And when he exaggerates it, he looks like he's trying to do a midair split. And the refs are like, get out of here.
Yeah.
You know? And he's the only guy that gets hit with that. But I'm with you. Like, Trey's stuff is so subtle. He's going to have to figure out how, you know, when he doesn't get it, he can get to that spot where he leans and jumps in, because he kind of misjudges where the guy behind him is. And the guy will kind of run by him, and then he'll go, oh, and try to jump in. And he'll have to cut those out. But you're right. I mean, he's so good at kind of snaking that pick and roll to where he gets the guy legit behind him, and then he just stops and goes for a pull-up, and there's nothing they can do. They're just going to run into him. And that's not going to change, because he's not jumping backwards. He's just stopping and going up for a shot. So I'm with you. Like, it's going to be interesting to see how he continues evolving, but I trust him to continue evolving because he's very clearly an offensive genius.
Yeah. See, this is the thing with Trae Young. Like, I think that what people don't recognize enough is that he is probably one of the three best ball handlers in the NBA, and he just carves up space.
Yes.
He just absolutely carves up space. So in these scenarios, if you drop your big man and you drop him too far back and you keep giving Trey the space and you let him get downhill, and your big still has to back up in order to deal with it, because he thinks, okay, I can just back up and then I can contest the floater.
Right.
You've lost. Because then your defense just naturally is going to have to collapse once he gets into the middle of the paint. Like, he naturally eats up space. You can't let him. That's the thing that you have to stop him from doing. You can't let him just eat up space like
that. And that's what the Bucks did in game two. That's what Brook did so much better. He met him above the free throw line, and he pushed him off of his spot. So if you watch Trey in game two, there were a lot of times where he would get to that elbow area, right where the free throw line hits the corner, and he would get pushed out. And what that does is it allows Brook more time to get back. It allows Drew a straight line to get between Trey and the basket.
Yep.
And it's not the area he wants to shoot his floater. So you buy yourself more time, and it takes a special amount of effort and talent to do that. And game two was one of the best Brook Lopez defensive games. That first half was one of the best defensive halves you'll ever see from a center. He was outrageous.
Yeah, I agree. I thought that Brook was really, really good in game seven of the Nets series, and he was really, really good in game two of this series.
And I think the question that you have to ask is, how much energy is that going to take? Because they were working. And the nice thing was, they got up by a billion and could rest everybody. But there's going to be nights where the Hawks hit shots that they didn't last night. And the question is, can you do that for 48 minutes? Because that's going to take a lot. But I think the biggest thing is, with Trey, and this goes to your eating up space, he's such a genius that if you show him the same look over and over and over again, he internalizes the read, and he doesn't have to see them anymore. If he sees the one guy, he knows where his keys are.
Yep.
So if you show him the same drop over and over and over again, the moment he sees which guy helps, he knows where that pass goes. He doesn't have to see the man he's throwing the pass to. And that's the difference between an elite passer and a very good passer. That's what separates Trey and LeBron and Jokic and Doncic.
Yep.
Is they don't have to see the guy they're passing to. They just have to see the read. Yep. And it's that, quarter second difference that gets guys wide open shots and gets guys contested shots.
And it's the ability for all four of those guys, particularly, to have such
to put it in the pocket.
Incredible control over the ball to be able to make a pass off of a live dribble. Don't have to stop their momentum.
Nope.
Don't have to jump stop. Don't have to get both hands on the ball. They can both just whip a pass off the bounce, left hand, right hand. It doesn't matter. And like you said, it goes directly in the shooting pocket.
In the pocket. And like that's what makes him so tricky.
Like, I think that you're right. If you show him the same look enough, Trey is going to figure it out. So, you know, look, Mike Budenholzer's gotten a lot of shit, and you covered Mike for a lot of years. Like, you understand the...
I know Mike very well.
The amount of, or I guess the lack of adjusting that is prevalent in his style of coaching.
He has done so much better this playoffs.
I agree. I think that last night's game, or 2 nights ago, I guess it was. I forget. Like, my brain is so warped by living in Australia in terms of, like, what day is what.
The game?
Yeah, like it's, and plus I've written no joke so far. I'm looking at my Word document for the draft guide. I've written 99,534 words for the draft guide so far.
I'm gonna say it. It's too many words, Sam.
I've, for what it's worth, last year's was like 102,000. So,
who? What poor soul has to edit this? Is this Sergio?
Sergio plays a role. The leads are Greg Rosenstein and Tyler Batiste.
Heavens to Betsy.
Yeah, heavens to Betsy.
Send those boys like a DoorDash gift card or something, because they're going to be batting down for days.
Oh, they will be getting like just absolutely handwritten like apologies from me. Not even thank yous, just apologies.
Just straight apologies.
So, like, between all of the film I'm watching on college guys to finalize those, like, draft profiles, and then the NBA, and then watching the NBA in the morning, by the way, because times are all fucked up here, I don't know what day it is most of the time.
It was last night, I can tell you that. But, yes, like, I can't imagine what your summers are like. That is not for me. I'm all set. It's probably what my falls used to be like at CBS when I would do college football, golf, and MMA all on the same like Saturday, Sunday.
See,
and run three live blogs and want to die.
Well, and like I've said on the podcast a couple times now, and I sent you a video. I move into my like new house on Monday, which is in probably, we settle it in 24 hours about, and we have all the movers coming on Tuesday. So in the midst of all of this, I am looking at a sea of boxes and garbage bags to move with.
It's a good look.
And it's a choice on my part. These things keep happening where like, oh yeah, we found a house that we love. Let's buy it. Mm-hmm. Oh wait, we have to close on it by June 30th because it's the end of the financial year in Australia. So the guy who built it wants to end up, you know, closing the financial year for tax reasons with the house being sold, right?
Sick.
So that's how's in the middle of
how's the housing market in Australia? Is it as disastrous as here?
Oh yeah, yeah. Oh yeah,
oh, yeah. That's right.
Like, yeah, not correct.
You should see the price of houses in Flagstaff.
It's
really fun, dude. People love Flagstaff because there's such a big rental market here.
I bet you get a ton of land though, too, right?
No. Not if you go further out. But no, man. Like, we'll be looking for at like 2-bed, 2-bath. Houses like we've been trying to find something that's not, and it's like 450,000-500,000, and I'm like, yeah, what the fuck am I supposed to do with that?
Yeah, that's
you think
that's
this blog money's long like that? What the fuck, man?
Oh man,
I have a desk and a punching bag in my bedroom because I live in a one bed, and I have to just so I have a gym, a bedroom, and an office all in one fucking 50 square foot space or something, 100 square foot space. That's right.
Yeah, we did not have when I lived in LA. We lived like in the middle of Hollywood, sure. Basically. And yeah, I mean, we did not have we had like a one bedroom. It was a choice. It was tough.
But like that, hey, saving a little money though. Weddings don't pay for themselves, brother.
Oh, the wedding to you've got a time coming up here as well, but it's sick. Yeah, the amount of anyway, the amount of boxes, the sea of boxes I'm staring into as we talk about this. I mean, it's sick. Fun. Let me tell you.
Basketball is happening.
Basketball stuff is happening. Let's talk a little bit. Do we have anything else we want to say about the Hawks? Like, I do think
I want to see how they bounce back.
Yeah,
they've been the most resilient team in the East so far. Them and the Bucks. Honestly, it's the reason they're both there. I'm interested to see what the adjustments are. Look, like, and part of this comes down to the fact that, like, if Bogey can't get his knee right, they might just be cooked. Like, yeah, they won by 7, and it was a little closer than that in game 1, and Trey had maybe the best game of his career.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just the load on Trey right now is so much, and, like, this isn't the fucking Sixers offense. You know? Like, they're not, like, I think the Bucks figured some things out as far as how to attack and get downhill in game 2. And, like, look, and the other thing is, if they're going to get good Drew games constantly, good luck. He's been great, because he was awful in the Brooklyn series. Awful.
Yeah, and I can't quite figure out what happened there still. Like, why was Drew so bad in that series?
I don't know if he was just... I feel like he felt lost for a bit in how to fit in the playoff offense. And I think it took him... Because, like, the Miami series, I don't think they ever got tested in the way that made them figure it out. And then Brooklyn kept switching and switching and switching. And it was just something they hadn't seen. And he looked like, of everybody, he looked like the one who was trying to defer the most. And I think somebody had to pull him aside and say, look, dude, like, we need you to go. You've got to attack. We've had Eric Bledsoe. We don't need Eric Bledsoe. Right? Like, we don't need you to defer to Giannis and defer to Chris. If you've got a matchup, take it. And I think that's what we've seen through 2 games in this Hawks series. And it helps that I think he's seeing defenders that he believes he can take. He's not seeing... He's seeing a banged-up Bogdanovich.
Yep.
Who he knows he can get to the rim on.
Yep.
He's seeing Kevin Herter, who Kevin Herter is a nice player, but and is another Kevin, guy that he can bully.
Kevin, by the way, like, underrated defender. He's been really good defensively in these playoffs.
He's very solid. He's just not...
Strong enough to deal with Drew getting a low center of gravity and just kind of going through him.
And then, and that's who he's, and then, like, what, he might see, like, a Solomon Hill, and he's just going to blow by. Like, there's.
Well, and like, there are times where he's seeing Trey.
Right. And the thing that he has done really well in the series, anytime he gets Trey, he's like, ball, yep, give it to me. Yep. And it's where the Bucks used to, what did we used to kill the Bucks for? Not hunting matchups. And now it's just like they see it and they go. And that's the biggest thing that I see. Like, they did it in the Miami series. Anytime anybody got Duncan Robinson, it was like dinner time. Ring the bell.
Yep.
Give me the ball. Whether it was Chris, Giannis, Drew, whoever got Duncan, it was like, ball me.
Or Kendrick, too. It was both.
Or Kendrick Dunn. Yeah, they just torched those. And if Tyler Hero was ever on the floor, they went at him, too. So.
Yep.
They've gotten a much better job. And the thing with Brooklyn was, Brooklyn doesn't have, like, the super, like, I think this is where they got kind of bogged down, is, like, against Miami, they could just ISO cook everybody. Brooklyn is easy to break down as a team, but they have decent ISO defenders.
Yep. Yeah, like Griffin, Joe Harris is even fine in isolation. Right,
Joe Harris, like, but what you want to do is, like, once you get the Nets in rotation, like, they're fucking cooked.
Right.
And so what they did is they just kept switching and switching and switching and baiting Giannis and everybody into, like, I guess I'll attack this. But I think Drew knew he didn't have a great, like, matchup ever in that series. And so he kept deferring, and they had to be like, look, man, you're not a 3-point shooter. Like, get your rhythm shots and then start taking threes. He was taking a ton of step backs in that Brooklyn series. So, yeah.
And that's definitely not his shot. Like, he is not a consistently awesome off-the-bounce shooter.
That sidestep in Game 7 was outrageous. After he missed everything, and he hit that sidestep 3 with, like, a minute and a half to go, I was like, okay, I see you. But, yes, that's not a shot he should be taking regularly. And he was taking a lot. Like, that's not first – basically, that's not a first-quarter shot for Drew. And he was doing that. So, Yeah, I mean, that's it. I'm interested to see how the Bucks keep up that energy defensively.
I guess my main question here is there another coach? Is Mike Budenholzer basically the equivalent of the no, yes shot that you see some guys take where, like, every time he's making a decision, it seems disastrous every single time. And then occasionally he'll just come up with some really good ones. And it's like, yes, well, he did it. He's Giannis shooting a three-pointer on the sidelines coaching the team.
I think for me, it's just like part of it is that Brooklyn series. It was like, I think he tried everything he could on KD. And it's just not a good option.
No, there's except not a good for, option on like, Kevin.
Except for, like, I guess people wanted him to just, like, stick Giannis out there, which, like, I don't know if that would have gone much better. But maybe, like, whatever.
Yeah.
But,
like I'll say this.
He did show, like, 8 different looks to KD, and KD was, like, just shooting over everyone. It was just like you just put different, like, styles of chair in front of KD. That's all Bud was doing. He's like, fuck, wheelie chair, recliner. The high chair. I don't fucking know.
The E. Gian Leon chair.
Just bucket. It was great. Eventually, though, KD got tired of seeing those chairs. Worn down by the chairs.
It took six
took
games.
7 games.
Well, no, it literally took 7 because of overtime.
It took 7 plus games, but by God, he got it done.
Oh my God, unbelievable.
Yeah. I'm also interested to see if Nate's willing to, also on the other side, like, you know how we used to hammer Bud for the rotations and playing too many bench guys?
Oh yeah, Nate's
McMillan, hey Bud, it's time to tighten that thing up a touch. Okongwu's giving you good minutes, I'm fine with him. The Solomon Hill minutes need to be a little tighter, I think.
Just need all to right. be a little tighter.
You just got, if it's not going well, like, we got to pull the plug a little faster. I know you're short there. Like, it sucks not having DeAndre Hunter. That's a big difference. But
and like, are they going to ever try to dust off Cam Reddish? Like, I think that's the interesting one.
Here's the other thing. Nate has never coached Cam.
I know, right? Like, that's a really tricky thing, I think.
He got hurt before Nate was the head coach.
Yeah.
He has not played, like, he doesn't know where he fits. He doesn't, like, obviously he was on the bench, but, like, I don't think he was, you know, when you're the assistant, you're thinking about whatever your assignments are and not necessarily full rotation. So, like, man, that'd be hard. And also, like, Cam, I don't think this is the series for Cam.
Well, I actually do think it would be really helpful to have him, because the one thing Cam has actually weirdly proven in the NBA is that
he can defend.
Pretty useful defensively, and having another big body who's laterally athletic that they can put on Chris Middleton, I think would be valuable in this series.
I think there's maybe, but also, like, how well is he moving?
Right.
I haven't seen and, like, there were times in the little bit that I saw of his minutes last night, I did not watch the fourth quarter. But a little, like, fuck that. The little bit I saw was, like, it looks like he's still trying to process things on the court. And that's always a death knell as a defender, is when you don't feel it and you're not reacting. So, like, we'll get to some Sun stuff. But that used to be my issue with DeAndre Ayton, is when you watch DeAndre Ayton play pick and roll coverage in his, like, rookie year, you could see the wheels turning.
Yeah.
And you could see him having to think through everything and process it before he moved.
Yep.
And, like, that is a split second you don't get in the NBA.
No, it really is. That's right.
And so I worry about Cam in that regard. It's hard. Like, you throw that guy out in a high, like, leverage situation in the playoffs, and, like, the Bucks are going to make him figure it out. They're going to go at him. And I just don't know if he's going to be processing things fast enough, because these guys have built such a groove.
Yep.
That, like, man, that's tough to throw a guy who hasn't played. And it's not his fault, to be clear. Like, I'm with you. Like, if Cam had been playing all this time, he would definitely be a guy getting minutes right now. I just don't know if you can throw him out there in this moment, but they might have to try, because they might just need to try something new in game 3 if it starts anything similar to game 2.
Or they just might need to dump the Solomon Hill minutes. Like, let's just be real about it,
I mean,
right?
The thing about the solo minutes is, like, if you throw him out there, you know 2 minutes in how it's going to go, right? You see how he's moving, like, If you want to use Solomon Hill for a couple fouls on Giannis, okay. But he better only be out there during the bonus to hit Giannis.
And by the way, like, I don't feel great about...
He can't be out there at the beginning. No.
I don't feel great about Cam Reddish on Giannis either. He's just not...
No. This would be a Middleton. This would be a Middleton assignment.
Yeah, so it's like it's a totally different assignment in terms of what they'd be doing. Let's take a quick commercial break, and we'll be back, and we'll talk a little bit about the dear sweet Phoenix Suns.
God, our Suns.
Let's talk about a different kind of performance than what we're talking about with the NCAA tournament. They want to help your performance in the bedroom. Joy Mode, you know, just like on the basketball court, sometimes you might have an off night. Maybe you're playing okay and you want to take your game up a level even. That's where Joy Mode is going to come in. Don't grab some over-the-counter pills that you see at a gas station. They're going to often contain unregulated chemicals, suggest unsafe doses, carry the risk of several other health problems down the road. That's why we've partnered with Joy Mode. Whether you're looking to spice up your intimate moments or increase your confidence in the bedroom, Joy Mode makes all natural and science-backed supplements dedicated to helping men perform better across their core functions. Their trademark product, the Sexual Performance Booster, is every man's solution for increased performance. It's like a pre-workout, but for sex. And get this, all ingredients have been assessed in peer-reviewed journals and researched in humans. Imagine this, it comes in a palm-sized packet like your favorite electrolyte powder. Just simply mix it with 6 to 8 ounces of water 45 minutes before sexual activity begins, and you're going to watch the magic unfold. Redefine your intimacy and go to use joymode.com for 20% off with code GAMETHEORY. That's G-A-M-E. T-H-E-O-R-Y. That's 20% off and free shipping with code GAME THEORY. Not only is this the only supplement you'll need in the bedroom, but it also supports blood vessel support, cardiovascular and heart health, athletic performance, blood pressure, and general erection function. So why settle for anything less? Whether you're happy or unhappy with your performance in the bedroom, why not perform even better with Joy Mode? Okay, and we're back. Let's talk about the Suns. So, did you see this DeAndre Ayton like leap coming? Because it has happened in the playoffs. He's been unbelievable in the playoffs.
Spectacular. So I wrote about it for Dime on Uproxx. So you can search it out there. I wrote about it. I didn't see it coming like this. But what I will say is, and this goes to kind of what I was saying earlier about when he was a rookie, when he first came in, I remember watching like his first three summer league games and like being like close to court level, and you can really see how the guys play defense, and like he's just thinking through everything, and you see him and he was lost in the sauce, and like, you know, the Suns don't know what the fuck they're doing at that point, because that was Igor's first year, only year. And I remember going to training camp, because they always come up the Flagstaff for training camp. God bless.
Yeah.
Which means I don't have to commute. It's great. For 1 week a year, Flagstaff's the place to be for basketball for me. So, and it's great because like nobody comes up. It's like Gina and Dwayne and like a couple other people, and it's like six people there for Suns camp, and it's fantastic. Like one TV camera. It's fan. I love it. I'm sure that won't be the case moving forward. But in 18, that was the case. 19, too. But so I remember talking to – I did a whole thing on his defense. You know, talking to Igor and talked to DeAndre a little bit. He was still rookie DeAndre. You remember talking to DeAndre. He's an interesting character. I enjoy him.
DeAndre's great.
I love him. But he's very short with his answers about, like, basketball stuff. Like, he's just to the point, done.
So you got to get him talking about like his teammates and like what they do, like how much fun they have and like all that stuff. Because it's the same in Arizona. I think I've only talked to him once since he's been in the NBA, like in a scrum. But like in Arizona, you'd catch him and you'd catch him in like the right mood. It'd be hysterical. Like he'd be hilarious.
Yeah. So a fun story about that. When I was, it was his first day at camp. And we were up there, and I guess at Arizona they didn't do scrums or call them scrums or whatever. Like he went, maybe they went to a press room, maybe they just did locker room.
Yeah, it didn't happen until the Pac-12 tournament, and then I felt like nobody really understood how good his personality was until then.
Right.
And like that first game, because I was there for the first game that they played in the Pac-12 tournament, and like people crowded around him because it's like, oh my god, like no one's talked to this guy all year really, and he just had people like fucking dying
in
laughing
stitches, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So but I guess they didn't call it a scrum. I guess they just said go meet with the media or whatever. Because Julie, who is one of the best PR people in the business with the Suns, comes up. And I was talking to her because I was setting up something to get Tyson Chandler one-on-one because that was his year with the team. And like I thought he would be a great person to talk to about what he's seen from DeAndre and that sort of stuff. And he was. He was fantastic. It was like 45 minutes after practice because he's an old man and needed 8,000 ice and heat things. But eventually we got it. I just like shot at the gym until he came. But so I'm walking with Julie, and she goes and grabs DeAndre. And she goes, DeAndre, it's time to go do the scrum. And he goes, the what? She goes, the scrum? He goes, what's that? And she's like, you know, you go talk to all the media over here. He goes, oh. And he turns to Josh Jackson. And he goes, Josh, I'm about to go do the scrum. And Josh was like, what the fuck, man? Like, all right. Like, good for you. And he comes over, and he walks up. And we're like, hey, DeAndre, you know, how are you doing? And he's like, I'm good. And then I just, you know, like, I just fire off the first question. And he turns to me, he goes, how are you doing? And I was like, I'm good, man. You know, like, just hanging out. You know, like, I appreciate your, you know, the thoughtfulness.
It seems like a really nice guy. Like,
he's just genuinely a nice dude. And, yeah. You know, like I remember doing that, and that was and the thing Tyson said is like once he figures it out mentally, he has every physical tool. Like you can't ask for anything more. Like the fluidity with which he moves on offense was always the thing that you pointed to, and you said like he should be able to do this defensively. He just doesn't right now because he doesn't know what he's doing. And that first year with the Suns, nobody knew what they were doing. Like that roster. Like, I mean, do you remember that team? That 2018-19 Suns team was a fucking disaster.
Yeah.
Like, they didn't have a point guard.
That was still, Marquise Chris around.
Marquise Chris was Dragon Bender was still on the team getting minutes. Josh Jackson was there. Like, they didn't have any sort of anything structurally.
Oh, God. Was that the Ariza signing year?
Yeah.
So oh, Trevor God.
Was at, Trevor was at camp, and he was looking like he was really enjoying life. that was a lot of fun. That was the year they traded. Yeah, they traded him for Oubre in the we told you the wrong Brooks trade with Memphis.
Oh, my God.
Which is still one of my favorite things I've ever heard.
Oh, 100% is.
Wrong Brooks. Sorry, we have to cancel this trade. It's like, that was the weirdest, trade collapse that I could remember until Bogdanovich to Milwaukee.
Oh, no, that the wrong Brooks is still the worst one, I think. That's just, insane to me how that happened.
But the Bogdan one was like, hey, this sign and trade is done. And Bogdan's like, the what? The first part of this is very important, guys. The sign part. I do not know what you're talking about. Which, imagine this fucking Bucks team with Bogdan instead of Pat Connaughton.
Oh, my God.
God! He'd already be in the finals. Anyway, so back to DeAndre. He needed structure, and that's what Monty brought to this team. Is, everybody on that team has a defined role outside of Booker and Chris Paul, right? Like, when you watch them play, it's what's helped McCall the most. It's what's helped DeAndre the most. Is like they know what they're supposed to do. Just do your job. And that's the easiest thing. That's the best way to help young players, right? Do your job. When guys don't know what their job is and they're trying to do a billion different things, and that was always how the Suns operated. No one knew what the fuck they were supposed to. Every fourth overall pick came into the Suns and was like, what do I do? And they're like, save us?
Go hoop.
Go hoop.
Just go hoop.
Yeah. And the only person who could do it is Devin Booker because Devin Booker is just a fucking hooper.
Right.
Right? But also, Devin has been helped by the structure on defense, you know? And he's allowed to do what he does on offense. But Chris Paul brings a natural structure to the offense. Like, if you play with Chris Paul, he's going to tell you what the fuck to do.
Right.
Even if that is, Devin, go do your thing. But sometimes it is, Devin, give me the damn ball. And, like, you have to respect when Chris Paul says that. Right. And he does, and he gives Chris the ball, and they take turns annihilating you from 15 feet. And I love watching it. But Ayton, like, the thing with that his leap has been is he's in his role. He's embraced his role, which his first year he didn't really do a lot. But I think, honestly, the 25-game suspension helped him a bit because he had to sit there next to Monty and get told what he would be doing. He had to watch every day. Here's what you're doing. Here's what you'll be doing. Here's what you'll be doing. What Aaron Baines is doing right now, you do that plus this. Like, it just, it was a structure that he needed. I think being off the floor and just watching is not something like anybody's ever going to do purposefully, is be like, hey, former number one pick, sit for 25 games. But I do think it helped him to just see what you're doing, see what it looks like on the floor. And then he stepped in and he was immediately solid. And now the confidence is there. And when you watch him move on defense, it is night and day from 3 years ago.
It really is.
Outrageous. He moves like he does on offense. And it's because when he's on offense, he is one of the most naturally gifted post movers that I can remember seeing in the last decade. Would that be a fair assessment to you?
I mean, are you talking like specifically on like post-ups, or are you talking about the way he like seals guys? Like, I think he seals guys really well. I think he moves his feet really well in ball screens. Like,
right. The way he, I guess the way he moves as a big man, I think, is just so fluid, and he know, and like, especially knowing how to use his size. And this is the thing I've always said about DeAndre, is like, he's 7 feet tall or 7'1", and he stands every fucking bit of it. That boy has the best posture I've ever seen.
Yep.
Standing next to him and standing next to like a, like if you stand next to KD, KD's 7 feet, but he kind of hunches a little bit. And you're like, okay, like, he's tall. You stand next to DeAndre and you're like, this is a mountain of a man.
Yeah. No, it's really hard to overstate how big DeAndre Ayton is until you stand next to
him. Giant. Yeah. Giant. I did an interview with him at Foot Locker in Chicago during All-Star. And there's a picture of me, and I'm not exactly a small human being. I'm 6'2". At the time, I was probably like 190. And like, the dude's just like a full foot taller than me. And he stands with such impeccable posture. Like, I'm like trying to like straighten my back out next to him, because I'm like, oh, this is how you're supposed to stand? Okay. But like, he uses that length so well. And he's just, his fluidity on offense is now the same as it is on defense. And that's such a big jump.
Yeah.
And like, he does the Roy Hibbert verticality thing. He's like, I'm just tall. Go around me. Good luck.
The thing that I feel most proud about getting right in pre-draft process is that DeAndre Ayton is going to be a good defender. Like, do you remember that pre-draft? Like, everyone just like shitting on DeAndre's defense after he made all Pac-12 defense.
That's why I wanted to write that piece. Is I was like, I don't know exactly what to believe, because like, when you watch him, you go, okay, like, I see the tools, but you also watch him and you go, can he figure it out mentally? Because it was like, he had the, it's like, because it was him, and then the next big in that draft was Jaren Jackson Jr.
Yep.
And you watched how naturally Jaren moves on that end of the floor.
Yep.
And you were like, can DeAndre ever do that? And sometimes it's hard for guys. Like, I remember when Jahlil Okafor came out, I had the same like issues watching. I'd watch him in the post and I'd be like, how is your footwork this fucking good on offense? And then you look like you have concrete shoes on defense.
It's just kind of, well,
figured it out.
Well, it's different skills too. Like, sure. in the post, having like good hip flexibility just matters a little bit less, right? Like, sure. When you're out in space, like, you need to be able to be flexible through your hips, drop your hips, slide, your hips, cut off, flip your hips. 100%. That's the stuff that like these bigger framed dudes struggle with, right? Like, like, there's even a guy in this upcoming draft named David Johnson at Louisville, right? David Johnson's a really good college defender, like really, really good. And I think he has a chance to be a great NBA defender. He's 6'5", but he just has like very thick, he's like a very thick lower half, right? Sure. And I just worry, like, how natural is it going to be flipping his hips against the quickest?
Can you unlock that?
Yeah, against the quickest guards in the NBA. If he unlocks that,
there's only so many guys that can do that. Like, yeah, PJ Tucker's, I think, the best example of a guy who can do that at that frame, right?
Right. Yeah. No. It's really, really hard.
And it's really rare. Like that's why PJ Tucker is who he is, and there. That's why everybody that gets compared to PJ Tucker is not PJ Tucker. Right.
Right.
Like you go, hey, he looks like him, and he tries hard, and it's like he doesn't have the same biomechanics. He doesn't have the same flexibility.
There's another guy. Draymond Green is another guy.
Yes. Yeah.
Like Dre is like a hefty dude. Naturally, and lost the weight, continued to like stay in shape throughout the course of his career so far, which is something that people had questions about with Dre pre-draft, and very clearly he's like proven them wrong. He's very clearly shown that he has that like hip flexibility as long as he stays in shape to be able to slide and cut dudes off. But it's interesting, and it's hard to try to I think that it's like that thing where people conflate like explosiveness with athleticism. There's a lot more to being a good athlete, like in terms of functional athleticism, playing on an NBA court. Like Luka Doncic is so functional in the way that his body and frame moves mechanically that he just knows how to carve out space.
Right.
So
yeah, 100%.
And DeAndre has none of those issues. DeAndre is built.
No, he's so fluid and like, moves so well. And I'm happy for him because he heard all that. He hated talking. Like I did. So I did that day one because I knew. I've been like the one thing you learn doing this long enough is if you're going to do the obvious story, do it immediately when guys haven't talked about it. Because guess what? By day four, DeAndre Ayton was not talking about defense. He shut down every question about it. He was like, I'm just doing what I can.
Yep.
All he would say. And like day one, he'll talk about it. Day four, he's been asked about it four straight days. The same questions. He shut it down. It's like when Lou Williams came back to Atlanta, I was the first person to talk to him at media day because he like snuck out to his table because, of course, Lou would sneak to his table. and I just happened to be over there talking to somebody else, and the whole scrum was with Horford or Teague or somebody who I didn't need to talk to because it was their 10th fucking year or something. And so Lou's over there, and I got to – and he was great. Talked about being back in Atlanta, loving being home. Went over to the scrum, did it again every fucking day at camp. Somebody new from a TV station or a radio station would come in and need to get the sound bite. And he eventually was like shutting down, wouldn't talk to anybody. I asked for him after practice week two as he was walking off the floor because we used to do scrums like just off to the side or just pull guys off to talk to him. And so Garen goes and runs over and you know, grabs Lou. He goes, hey, like Robbie wants to talk to you. And Lou just keeps walking. He goes, no comment, no comment, no comment. It's great to be home. And just like tries to keep walking, and Garen's like, come on. And he walks over to me, and I cut a deal with Lou that day. I was like, if I ever ask you about being back in Atlanta for the rest of your time here, you never have to talk to me again. And he was like, bet. So we just talked hoop. We talked hoop, and we talked Zaxby's chicken sandwiches because that's a passion of Lou Williams.
Oh my
god, he's a connoisseur of all things fried chicken.
Yeah.
And wings and sauces, and he's got takes, man. He loves his Zaxby's.
See, these are the important things that we get when we have Robbie Calland on the podcast, and they're very important, and I love them.
So there's a little inside the Lemon Pepper Lou. This is not a shtick. This is not something new. He's been about that life. Wings and things at Zaxby's. You know how it is. But so, anyway, so offensively, like we knew what DeAndre could do, right? And he's given structure and he's bought into the idea of I'm the third guy, but I can dominate as the third guy. And that's such a hard thing for some young guys to do, right? Like he's a number one overall pick and he's the third option. But he has said, I'm going to be the best damn third option in the NBA. And he might be.
He probably is. If we're being real about it, like he probably is.
Especially of these final four teams. I think you have a very strong, it's like him and Holiday.
Him and Drew.
Reggie Jackson.
Yeah, you know what? Drew probably is better than DeAndre Ayton right now.
But like, it's just very close.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, I mean, like that's it. Like of the teams, like obviously if Brooklyn's healthy, that's a different conversation.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, like that's been the most impressive thing to me is I think it's a mental thing with him more than anything on both ends. It was, can he learn to process defensively? I think that was giving him a structure and telling him what he's looking for. And then he can just move naturally. And then offensively, it was embrace what your role is. And that comes down to him having a ton of respect for Monty. That's all it is. Not a lot of coaches can get a guy to do that. But he, He has embraced Monty. He pushed back early. He didn't like Monty initially. He didn't like all of the structure. He didn't like how hard it was initially. But he bought in, and he's put in the work. They've talked about on the broadcast where, like, he didn't used to want to come in on the off days. He didn't want to put in that work, and Monty used to get on him about it. And he's bought in now.
The Monty Williams of this whole thing is just so impressive to me. He's done such a phenomenal job, just not only in terms of structure, but do you remember when he was the coach in New Orleans? There was so much consternation about, is he actually like able to run the right things for mm-hmm. Anthony Davis? Can he like actually run the right sets? Can he be creative enough offensively?
Because yeah, and him and Chris didn't get along initially either.
I think I forgot that.
In New Orleans, like that's like Chris didn't really love playing for him. So there were like a lot of questions, and he's obviously his personal journey is well documented, but I mean professionally I think he put in the work, and he was like, when you talk to him, he's got such an incredible perspective because of everything he's been through personally, professionally, all of that. Like, he's just really like an impressive guy. And he's also become a really impressive coach.
He really has. And
I think that's the thing. Like, we talk about who can make adjustments, these sort of things. Like, he's dialed up the right things at the right time.
He really does. Wise, yeah, he's become one of the better adjustment coaches in the NBA. Like, he sees something on the court. Forte.
And that was not what he was known for.
Like, process it and be like, okay, let's implement this.
And it comes down to, and like, I think you see it the most in Phoenix's wing rotation, right? Like, when he kind of has been able to, like, he's maximized Cam Johnson's minutes in a way I don't think a lot of people thought could be done, you know? And Cam is another guy that's just embraced the role he's been given. You know, everybody knew he could shoot, but he's become an awesome cutter.
Yep.
Like, he's become really good at just finding those pockets. And I think part of that is, if you play with Chris Paul, he's going to tell you when to cut enough in practice that you just kind of learn how to do it. Because he's just going to yell at you until you do it right.
He really is, isn't he?
Like, I think that's, like, you know, like, the Chris Paul leadership thing has become a meme, and rightfully so. Like, it gets talked about so fucking much, and it's painful sometimes. But there are certain tangible things that I think you can point to as, like, DeAndre Ayton's patience in pick and roll, I think you can directly tie to Chris Paul. Because who's the most patient pick and roll ball handler in the league? It's Chris Paul.
And defensively in pick and roll, too.
Yeah, the dude will string you out. He'll just keep kind of pressing. He'll keep a guy on his hip. And then he'll force the big to keep stepping out until he's just far enough back where you know he can't get back to the lob. And then you throw it up. And you know the weak side help has no chance against a DeAndre Ayton jumping. And what you see from Ayton is he does these little delayed rolls where he'll like stick his guy, and instead of just sprinting to the basket, he'll take like he'll come wide. He just like swings out wide, takes like three steps to get to the other side of the lane, and then he cuts down. And it's just nobody, because at first you think, is DeAndre Ayton popping? Like, we're gonna give him that. And so the big kind of loses sight of him for a half second. And then he just jumps down the lane, and at that point, it's too late.
Yep.
And those are things. The Cam Johnson cutting, like, knowing the timing of that, I guarantee you Chris Paul has given him every curse word in the book in practice about, you're supposed to fucking be here now. And, like, at some point, that just becomes habit when you get yelled at for the thousandth time. It's like, shit, I guess I better be there.
I just don't want to get yelled at anymore. Like,
I just don't want to hear it from Chris. He's an angry, tiny little man.
Oh, man. Oh, Chris Paul. What a legend. Yeah, we think the Suns are going to win this series, right?
I think so. Because, like, here's the thing. I think you could tell that game three was Chris and I think Devin was deferring to Chris early, and so he never got in his rhythm. Chris was trying to establish himself and was just not able to hit shots that he hits. Then Devin starts pressing. And it just, like, their rhythm got thrown off. One, feed DeAndre Ayton more. He was feasting in the first quarter, and then they went away from him. Didn't look for him as much as they need to. Like, he's the biggest advantage in the series. Like, Zubac was great, don't get me wrong, but like part of that was like they just weren't getting the man the same touches, and like I just think they've got to look for him a little more. And I think part of that was both Book and Paul being off were both trying to get themselves going, and I understand that because they're not going to win if neither of those guys is going. But I think you got to keep DeAndre engaged and involved a little more offensively, more consistently. But yeah, I'm with you. I think Suns in six or seven.
Yeah, I think six, to be honest. I think I'd say yeah. Six. Okay. So for people who have not seen the Fast and Furious movie that just came out, F9, starring Vin Diesel, John Cena, Michelle Rodriguez.
Michelle Rodriguez.
Sung Kong. Tyrese.
Ludacris.
Natalie Emanuel. Who else we got? We got...
Who plays Mia?
Jordana Brewster, of course.
Jordana Brewster, yes.
We got, Young Dom.
Young Cena.
Yeah, we got...
NBA fans will know him as the guy you see on all the Animal Kingdom commercials.
The guy you see on all the Animal Kingdom commercials. Oh my God, that's right. Yeah,
that's Young Cena in the movie.
That's right.
That's the NBA connection to F9. Every time you've seen those fucking promos for a show you've probably never watched, but you damn sure have seen every NBA fan knows a lot about the Animal Kingdom like upcoming season and the end of every Bones episode.
Or Supernatural, you know?
Or Supernatural if you leave it on overnight and cut your TV on.
Which, by the way, I've seen at least 150 episodes of Supernatural in full.
Of course you have.
I've not seen any Animal Kingdom. I've seen, like, you know, maybe 10 episodes of Bones. I've seen a lot of Supernatural in my life.
A lot of Supernatural.
Because it's
big
just...
Supernatural guy here.
It's a good show to watch that's really stupid... While you play MLB The Show, for instance.
Okay.
Like,
I'd
you know.
That.
It's a good dumb show.
You've got to have those.
And we're going to talk some spoilers within this thing. So if you haven't seen F9 yet, like, this is the time. Like, you got to cut it off.
Eject.
Yeah. Ejecto Cito, cuz, on the podcast.
Ejecto Cito, cuz.
Ejecto Podcasto, cuz.
That's right.
Okay. So... Important announcement here from People Magazine today.
Oh God!
You actually might need to blog this. Like, I might be like, you know, telling you something that you have to go and do
content.
Work with now.
Content. Yeah. I'm off today, so I won't. But that's okay.
Vin Diesel says he would do a Fast and Furious musical. "Quote: I'm dying to do it."
Vin Diesel loves to sing. He truly believes he has some pipes. And I aspire to that self-confidence.
Is there a more self-confident person on the planet than Vin Diesel?
I don't think so.
I really don't.
He is the Jordan Clarkson of Hollywood.
I mean, no disrespect to Vin. I think he's like an inch taller than I am, and that dude legit thinks he could kick the rock's ass.
I love it.
Like, it's what a world that we live in.
We'll get to it. I got some thoughts on that whole situation.
Okay, so Fast 9, let's just start here. What were your overall thoughts?
Loved it. Everything I needed. It was a delight. Like, look, like it's fucking preposterous. But guess what? That's what I'm here for. All
it's
right?
So preposterous.
It is. There are at least 12 scenes that Crystal and I legitimately laughed out loud at.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Laura and I,
that
too.
That weren't necessarily, like, comedy things, but were just so absurd in the action department that we just started cackling in the theater.
But you know what, though? Like, Justin Lin...
But that's what I want!
Yeah, like, he knows that going... Like, it's...
I don't think it's a situation.
Yeah, where, like, oh, you're not supposed to have fun at these movies. Like, it's...
No!
It's intentional, unintentional comedy, kind of?
Yes. So I once did an interview, and this is one of my favorite things I've ever done. And, like, I didn't care that I probably should have given this to movies. I was not turning down this PR op. I talked to Michelle Rodriguez and her stunt woman about the Fast and Furious stunts.
Oh, that's amazing.
After, I think, 7. And it was such a fun interview. And, like, it was kind of funny because, like, I asked about some of the absurdity of it. And they're like, well, I mean, like, everything, like, we try to do everything. you know? And, like, I was like, okay, but, like, look, I watched the movie, and Vin spears you out of midair into a car. Okay? Like, I respect the hustle here, but, like, okay. But, like, so, like, they take it, they don't want it to be seen as, like, a ridiculous joke. Like, they take what they do seriously, but at the same time, they're also, like, we just want to go as big as possible.
Totally.
And I was like, I respect the shit out of that. Like, and so they were great to talk to, and, like, it was fun because it was her stunt driver specifically. So, like, it was mostly about, like, driving stunts. And all of those are things that they fucking do. And so that was really cool to just talk about and be like, how? You know, basically, like, I just kept coming up with examples and being like, what about this one? How did you do this one? And it was so much fun. But yeah, I mean, like, and even in this movie, they kind of address all of it. You know, the whole, like, Roman being like, are we invincible?
Oh yeah, like, you have to do it at this point, I think.
They break the third wall with it a little bit.
I think the thing I liked most about this movie, and I think I liked it maybe 10% less than you did. I liked it. Like, I had a great time at the movies. I thought it was super fucking fun. I think I liked it maybe 10% less than you did. But sure. The thing that I liked most about it was it feels like they're very self-aware at this point.
Very much so.
They know what the deal is, and they're just going for it.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, and I think that, especially, like, the fact that they're, like, for years, I think since 6, I would say, the joke has been, like, oh, they're going to end up in space. And Justin was like, you're goddamn right we are. And how they did it was awesome. Like, they didn't have them in, like, fucking, like, spaceships and shit.
Can I see
them
in a car?
They have a Pontiac Fiero! It's fucking incredible.
This is absolutely a spoiler. Incredible. We have given
spoilers.
People. We have given people more than enough time.
Get the fuck out.
Like,
also, it's in the goddamn previews.
Yeah. We've given people more than enough time at this point.
Okay. All right. Roman and Tej are in a fucking Fiero in space. All right. God bless America.
Like, that's all I gotta say. Okay. So, in terms of the storyline, it's fun. The fact that Dom has a brother that is John Cena.
That's 100% the funniest part of it.
Is 100% the funniest part.
Also, well,
I don't know if it's the funniest part. There's a lot of funny parts.
But of that specific Dom, everybody's like, Dom has, like, the Dom has a brother thing was like, how is it to the 9th movie? And it was like, no, like, we need to focus on the fact that Dom's brother looks like John Cena. And I think the funniest part of it was they addressed that in the cheekiest way with Charlize Theron saying, like, I knew the Toretto family had a lot of, like, different mixed bloodlines and stuff, but I didn't know Nordic was in there. And it was like this tongue-in-cheek fucking, like, yeah, John Cena doesn't look a fucking thing like Dom Toretto. Dom speaks Spanish. John Cena does not speak Spanish. I would love to hear John Cena speak Spanish, though. I want to be clear about that.
I would too. What a dream. John Cena, West Newbury, Massachusetts own John Cena.
Right. Like, this motherfucker's supposed to be not just related, but the brother of the man who, like, spends all his time in Mexico and the Dominican Republic and Cuba.
By the way, basically works. Like, let's be honest. Like, it basically works.
It does. That's the wildest part. And, like, I think my favorite part of it is, like, they knew everything people would try to poke a hole in.
Yeah.
They knew it, and they address every single thing, and totally. They do it in, like, 10 seconds.
So,
and they're like, how is Han still alive? And they're like, bitch,
that's what
glad you asked.
That's what I wanted to talk about. Asked. I think that is probably the worst handled part of the movie. Because,
but you know what? I don't care.
They just kind of hand wave it, and, like, most of the time they've been more intentional about the way that they make the continuity work, which this thing is like a continuity. This series is continuity, like, genius level approach, but also disaster, like, simultaneously.
Sure.
the fact that like they retconned 3 to essentially be 7 in the or 6 I think it is in the actual chronology of this thing was really smart, and
they did it with a 20 minute short that Vin Diesel shot himself.
Right, they did that, and then on top of it they also did it in a way where the pieces fit together in a really smart way. I don't think that the pieces totally fit together here.
Well, like, they don't.
Like, Han surviving is great, but, like, oh, yeah, Mr. Nobody. Like, the, just the, well, like, I'll ghost of this, Mr. I'll Nobody existing.
Well, I'll say this. It's as, I think that's when they introduce, like, the Mr. Nobody character and that he can get anything done and is all over the place and has unlimited resources and all that. I think that just sort of, like, opened up the door for this. And they saw, like, the window, and everybody was like, why'd you kill Han? And they're like, okay, fine.
Yeah.
Because that was what happened, is, like, people complained so much that Han had been killed off that they were like, fine, we'll figure it out. And that's why it wasn't the same as the Letty thing or 3 being actually 7 and all of that, is because you're kind of like... It was kind of just addressing, like, fans being like, we want Han back. And it was like, all right, we'll make it happen. Fuck it, we brought 3 people back from the dead already. Why not another?
But we definitely think Gal Gadot is alive, right?
No.
Is it just... So. Is it only because Gal Gadot is too big of a star?
Yes.
whereas Sung Kong is like very good friends with Justin Lin and like will come back, and Gal Gadot is like, just not
Gal,
at this point.
Gal is, she's Wonder Woman, she's got other shit to do, and like I think they moved on there. Also part of it is like I don't think people were nearly as attached to the character of Giselle in the same way, because that she never got the same development. One, because she's introduced in the worst of the movies.
Ooh, disagree. Four. We're gonna have a ranking at the end of this, but yeah.
You don't think 4 is the worst?
I don't.
I think 4 is important. It's the only way we get to the best part of the series. Like,
yeah.
Had that 4 as like the tie-in, but like 4 is like, 4 was when they were in, like, we'll get to it, but 4 is when they were in kind of like limbo between like, we're a car movie and we're also just a crazy action franchise. Like, they haven't figured it out yet. Anyway, back to F9. So Han's back.
Han is back.
It's a delight. And
I'm going to say this. I'm going to bet you that this when the series ends, whenever that is, and God forbid the day that that series ends, because we love it dearly. They're going to have Gal Gadot come out for like 10 minutes in that movie and just like end up with
possibly
long term.
It's possible. That's possible.
Like, I think that's going to happen.
I wouldn't rule it out, but I will say, like, I don't foresee her until maybe then. I don't think we'll see her back until maybe a final movie. I'm with you, but that's that.
The other thing please, with this movie that I think it does really miss.
Okay.
It miss, and I felt this way about 8 too. It drastically misses this everyman that is Brian, who is essentially like, I don't even know that he's like the like window in from like for the audience, but he kind of is, because he's not like this, you know, superhuman, super jack dude, or not like the joke guys like Tyrese and Ludacris. Sure. Like, he is just the like incredibly good looking but also like normal human who's just like the police officer, right?
I feel you, but like,
it's an intentional choice because Vin like runs the franchise, but like they shoehorn Dom into that role, and Dom is a lot better being just like slightly off center as like the mythic figure within the franchise, as opposed to being like the window into the audience like he is in this movie.
I would say in this one, honestly, I think my argument would be that Letty's closer to that.
But
as far as the normalish human in this.
But it can't like be because there's so much going on with Dom's background in this movie. Like, the whole thing is like explaining Dom's like past.
Yeah.
It's definitely his perspective movie because like it's his family, it's his brother, it's his past that we keep flashing back to. Like, I think that part of it works just a little bit worse in the construct of the series, in the dynamic of the group.
Right, and I also, like, again, like, it's because Dom won't let them add somebody else who would possibly be taking Brian's spot.
Right.
Like, Vince just not gonna let that happen. And I understand it, and, like, I do like the ways that they keep... I wasn't, like... Again, like, all the things that were going to be questions, they kind of address, like, why is Mia there and Brian's not? Well, it's Mia's brother.
Right.
And Brian's taking care of all the kids. Like, okay.
Yeah, I think that's done well. That's done really well.
It plays.
It plays.
It's like, it plays, like, we know, the thing is, we know why. You know, it's not like there's some contractual dispute that's leading to this. Like, we know fucking why this is happening, and we respect that. And so... I think they handled all, like, the ridiculous questions you're going to have about this stuff, and they handled it pretty well. Also, it was fun to see the guys from 3 back. It was fun to see the Tokyo guys back.
And
I loved how they did it. I love seeing Chubby Bow Wow.
Yeah. Bow Wow. Good for him.
I purposely didn't watch every trailer, but, like, I didn't remember seeing him, so I was like, oh, look at him.
And I'll be honest, I totally forgot Earl. Initially, I thought that Justin Lin, because have you ever seen Better Luck Tomorrow, the movie that Han gets introduced in?
I haven't.
So, amazing movie. Like, fucking incredible movie. Honestly, one of my, like, I don't know, like, I see a lot of movies. It's probably, like, somewhere in my top, like, 50, you know, or so movies. Top 100 movies I've seen since 2000. The guy, so Jason Tobin is Earl in that movie, and he is, like, he's, like, the second lead in Better Luck Tomorrow. His name is Virgil Hugh. And I thought it was just Virgil that was there, and, like, Virgil did not... I won't, like, spoil... I won't spoil Better Luck Tomorrow, but, like, I was, like, sitting there, I was like, wait, did they just bring in another Better Luck Tomorrow character? And then I was like, oh, no, wait, like, he was actually in Fast 9. But I love that. Like, I thought it was super fun. Like, making Sean, like, a engineer of, like, rockets, essentially.
Yeah. But, like, he's, like, just, like, the mechanic guy, and then you have... You know, Earl doing the actual rocket scientist things.
Yeah, it was great. And it was super fun.
And then also, like, yeah, so, like, and, like, also, like, that they were still, it's basically, it was the same vibe as when they used to be sitting outside back at Han's shop, just, like, tooling up cars and having him wreck a bunch. It was the exact same vibe, and I love that. Like, it was, like, just, for all the wild things that they do that make this series, like, make it so the series just should not work as a piece of continuity. The little things are what keep it together.
It really,
like,
is.
The little notes like that. So it's like that. It's like Dom still holds the fucking Corona the same way. Like, it's little notes like that that they hit, and they're so good at hitting that you are willing to ignore that Tej used to run jet ski races and now he's the best hacker in the world. And also can now fight?
It also can fight. Yeah, like, when did that happen?
Also now we have no idea. I think actually 7. I think 7 was when that happened. Because remember, they showed him, that was the first fight when they were in Abu Dhabi. And, like, he was, like, hacking in the computer room. And, like, that guard came and, like, attacked him and Ramsey or whatever. And he, like, fought the guy off. That was the first time we saw Ludacris in the fight. So that's when he learned. Sometime between 6 and 7.
Okay. So what was your favorite action set piece within this movie? Because there are a lot.
Ooh, there are so many. I thought the most fun was Helen Mirren's driving scene.
I'm so glad you said that, because I agree. That actually was also... I was going, like, off board with that, but I totally agree with you. I thought it was so
fun. That was the most fun. Because here's the thing, is Helen Mirren has been asking for this for, like, 5 years. Like, Brian Grubb has written this a million times because he loves it. It's like, she wanted to be in the franchise, she wanted to drive in the franchise, and so they got her in the franchise in 8, and then they were just like, fuck it, here's your driving scene. And it was so good. Like, having her and Dom kind of having the interplay, and, like, it also, like, tied, like, it was, what, a five-minute scene tops, and it tied, like, three things together? Like, that's the thing that I think they do as well as any action franchise outside of Mission Impossible, is just being like, we're not going to show you 30 minutes of filler. We're going to let 3 minutes of dialogue tell the story and progress it while we're doing action.
Yeah, they do the information dump better than anyone.
Because we know what you're here for.
Yeah.
You know, I think them and Mission Impossible does it phenomenally. Yeah. And I think it also comes, and I think honestly the strength of both is having two stars who have complete ownership of the franchise. And they know what story they're trying to tell. Tom Cruise is the one telling the story in Mission Impossible, and he knows what people want, and that's Tom Cruise doing Tom Cruise shit.
Yep.
All right? How do we get to more Tom Cruise doing Tom Cruise shit? Let me just tell you, or let Benji tell you. Yep. Or let Ving Rhames tell you between Arby's commercials. Dom does the same thing.
Yeah.
And they introduce these little characters that Mr. Nobody is like, all Mr. Nobody was there to do was to explain things in 3 minutes and get the fuck out.
Yep. Progress the plot.
Beautifully. Yeah. That's all he was there for. Every person from a government agency, that's all they've been there to do.
Except for The Rock.
Except for The Rock, because The Rock is there to be The Rock. And God damn it, he does that better than anybody else.
And I do think that this movie misses that aspect. In general, misses the dynamic.
Every movie without The Rock. Every movie without The Rock misses
like,
The
Rock. Like, give me Minari, except with The Rock. Like, that's what I need. Give me Nomadland, where The Rock is playing Francis McDormand's character.
My favorite thing, if you go back and watch Fast Five, the first half of Fast Five, The Rock is attempting an accent.
Oh, yeah.
He's trying to do, go get this for me. And then by the end of the movie, he's just the fucking Rock. And like, he's like, why am I doing this? And I think that's why Vin doesn't like him, is like Vin's thing is like he doesn't try hard enough acting. And it's like, Vin, we don't want The Rock to act. We want to see The Rock. Okay? You know what I popped for the most? Is when The Rock did the rock bottom on Jason Statham through a fucking table. I was like, there it is! I did the fucking Once Upon a Time in Hollywood thing in the theater. The rock bottom! He did it! It's great.
Well,
that's what I'm here for.
Like, one of the best scenes in all of these movies is The Rock and Vin Diesel fighting in Fast Five.
Yes!
Like, that scene's incredible.
So good. Just, like, beating each other with pipes.
Yeah. And then eventually, Vin Diesel decides not to hit him with the wrench, which is a callback to this movie, because we basically see
him. You know what? Do it. I will say this. The restraint to bring out Dom's brother this late is honestly incredible.
Oh, honestly. My God. Here's the real thing that I'm wondering. Can you shoehorn in John Cena as the straight man within these movies and then move Vin Diesel slightly off center? I think it'll happen because I think that Vin will just continue to be the center of it. And he should be the center of the franchise, but I wonder if you can make it like a two-man situation with John Cena. I don't know, though.
Obviously, they've set this up where next movie, Cena's in the crew.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert.
John Cena's not the bad guy. Yeah.
John Cena, well, he's the bad guy until he realizes it's all about the family.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Right? It's all about the family. Shouts to Ike Barinholtz and Blockers. It's all about the family.
That movie's underrated great.
Oh, one of my favorite comedies of the last decade, for sure. Yeah. And Ike Barinholtz carries. Also, another great Cena movie. I think they handled a lot of this really well. They did it tongue-in-cheek where it needed to be tongue-in-cheek. And they were just like, fuck it, we're going to move on. And you're going to, by the end of it, you're going to forget all this because you're going to be watching these guys use electromagnets to fuck up a impenetrable train thing.
That's one question I had. Were you surprised by the usage of magnets in this movie? I was not expecting as many magnets as what there were.
I wasn't, but I was really glad they did it because, again, it was one of those weird little things that they do, which is they introduce it at the very beginning with, spoiler, Cena's car launching off a cliff, and being caught by a plane with electromagnets.
Which is amazing.
Which was fucking amazing. And then they keep using the electromagnets. So the bad guys are now robbing a U.S. like storage facility under a cathedral in Edinburgh, Scotland, which, like, sure, man. And they do it with electromagnets to scramble security and shit. And, like, as soon as they had the guys wheel in that big box, I was like, John Cena's in that box.
I knew it. And then the other thing about it, too, is they do a really good job of playing it for comedy as well. Yes. Like when Natalie Emanuel is driving, and that scene plays really well too, I think.
I thought so as well.
Yeah, she's trying to like figure out how to drive while also trying to figure out how to use magnets. Like there's that scene where the car literally goes through the building because the magnet has been turned up. And I don't know if the science works on all of the magnet stuff in this movie.
That's how they caught John Cena.
I don't know, but I don't care.
That was awesome. Also, they didn't explain that, like, the fucking car went like into the side of the truck where like all of them were, and like, and none of them were harmed, and also John Cena wasn't harmed by his car going through a building and into the truck. But guess what? Who cares?
I don't care. It's so much fun.
So good. And then they like rig up their cars with magnets, and like, I was glad, because here's the, like, okay, like, we've got this new tech. That's what I would do, too, is I would be like, wow, this could be really useful. Like, let's fucking use it. And so, like, the fact that they kept doing that and just, like, it was the same in 6 with, like, the harpoons and shit, the harpoon gun.
Yeah.
That they're always dicking around with. Like, where Ludacris puts fucking Nos on the harpoon gun. Like I appreciate that they do those things, and like that it's not just like they kind of introduce you to what they're going to be using before they use it in the big finale scene. And like I think it's a nice little thing to explain like how they got it. Again, it's letting 2 minutes of action tell a big piece of the story. They didn't need to go like find this, and like Ludacris wasn't in the lab like working on electromagnets for 2 years and bringing it to the crew. It was just like, hey, we found this cool shit from the bad guys. Let's use it against them. Totally. And it was awesome.
Okay.
It was awesome.
You wanted to do a thing on The Rock. Let's do your thing on The Rock.
Let's do it on The Rock. So yeah, I mean, I think the end, the end credit scene, which I hope people stayed around for. I think we know at this point to just do that.
Totally.
Where Jason Statham's there beating up a guy in a punching bag, which was very funny. I enjoyed that. Shouts to Jason Statham, who has never... I think the reason Statham and The Rock, I love them both so much, is they're always just playing themselves.
Oh, yeah, totally.
When was the last Jason Statham movie where he just wasn't Jason Statham?
Where he wasn't Jason Statham? Oh, God. I'm, like, trying to think.
It's now. Like pre-Transporter.
Yeah. I actually just watched The Transporter recently, and it's like... The score is a mess, and like it's kind of a weird movie, but it's fun.
Driving holds up.
Yeah,
the driving holds up.
It's great. Really does. Trying to think. Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know.
Even in the Italian Job, he's pretty much just Jason Statham.
The Meg, he's definitely Jason Statham.
He's 1,000% Jason Statham.
Yeah. Have you seen Wrath of Man, the new Guy Ritchie movie?
No, but is he Jason Statham?
He's Jason Statham. Yeah.
Hell
he's,
yeah.
The second mechanic movie.
Mechanic Resurrection, the pool scene in Mechanic Resurrection.
Yeah. He's the same guy in every movie. It's great. Same guy,
and that's why like him and The Rock, they just go play the hits, god damn it.
Yeah.
All right.
By the way, there's a Jason Statham spy movie coming out with Aubrey Plaza, and it's directed by Guy Ritchie, and I'm just in. Like, just take my money now.
Maybe twice.
Yeah.
Fucking just goodness.
Just take my money now.
Yeah, just give it to me. But anyway, so I think what they've set up here is like we know The Rock, Hobbs, and Shaw are a thing. First off, I think that movie, everybody was like, oh, they're splintering off. I think it was the here's you guys' movie so that you get that big box office rev because y'all are not going to be in 9. We have another story to tell. They'll be back for 10. I think everybody's back for 10.
I hope so. I mean, like, it's hard to say. Like, I can't tell where, like, the like drama within like behind the scenes stuff ends and the whole thing begins.
I think so. Vin, the fact that Vin was a little more open about it this time around, it seemed based on some interviews that I saw where he was just like, you know, like I thought, like I felt like I needed to push The Rock more and we had some issues with that. It sounded more like a past thing, you know, like the way he talked about it. And so I like to believe that we bring this all full circle. I think setting up, obviously, a Han-Shaw little confrontation at the end there needs to happen. Because, again, you have to explain somehow how all this shit's going to work out. Because, like, hey, you tried to kill me. We can't just, like, hop in to be
right.
Teammates. But, yeah, like, I think they've set it up for everybody coming together in 10. And, again, I think the Hobbs and Shaw thing was, all right, we don't have a spot for you in 9. Also, the Vin Rock thing is weird. You guys do your thing, make $1 billion, and then we'll do 9 without you. Everybody's gonna be back in the pool for 10. That's what I foresee. Because again, it's hard. I think it'd be hard for them to bring Statham in, and also I think it sets up they're gonna set up a cool Rock Cena thing.
Oh, I hope so. That'd be amazing.
Has to.
We liked Hobbs and Shaw, right?
Loved it.
Yeah, I did too.
I mean, it was fun. Again, it was stupid fun. Like, Idris Elba's a superhuman? Sure, sign me up.
Let's yeah, I'm definitely...
What are you talking about?
Like, definitely in on those movies.
People who didn't like it, it was like... One, like, this, like again, it's like the Statham-Rock dynamic. Like, their entire personas in every movie is like being like the tough guy, snarky humor guy. And so they just get to play off of each other doing that. And then you bring in his sister, who just gets to basically be like, y'all are being stop the dick measuring contest and let's fucking go do stuff. Like, call out how stupid and kind of overly masculine both of them are. And like, I think that is what is needed in that.
Just find a more age appropriate sister. You know, that's my only thing. Like, that's all I need. You know, it's not...
Listen.
Not ideal when you see both Jason Statham and Vanessa Kirby as children, and Jason Statham is, God, has to be 17 years older than Vanessa Kirby.
Yeah. Hollywood's not the best about that.
Like, that's a problem, and we should be real about that. That was a real problem. Yeah, but
that was a bit of an issue, but...
I actually really liked Hobbs and Shaw beyond that.
I thought it was fun, man. This is a fun movie. It hit all the notes, you know?
Here's my take. I liked Hobbs and Shaw better than this movie.
Ooh!
But we'll talk about that, because the thing I want to move to next is Fast and Furious rankings.
See, I always struggle with this right after seeing one.
Yeah.
Because I always feel like I'm a little too in the moment. I'll work bottom up.
Okay.
I think. Okay. So let's go bottom up.
Okay.
I have 4 at the bottom.
Yep.
Again, for the reasons I said. Like, I think it was the one that they were the most confused in. The pacing wasn't as good as what it has become, or what it was, I think. And I just think some of it was, like, the main action pieces weren't as good as they got to be, and the story wasn't as good as what one was, especially, and kind of the early ones. And I just didn't have as much fun watching it as, like, 2 and 3. Like, 2 and 3 were dumb fun movies without as much of the action.
Yeah,
It was car action, not action. And 4 was like, do we still do car action or do we do action? How do we do both? How do we tell an intriguing story? And like, just a lot of moving parts. But when I say 4 is the worst one, it's also one of the most important ones because we don't get to where we got without it.
Yeah, I think 2, 3, and 4. Are the 3 worst?
The bottom 3.
They're the
and I would go 4, 2, 3 for me. I have a soft spot for Tokyo Drift.
I do too. I don't have Tokyo Drift last. I have 2 last. 2 is
I think that's just fair.
A ridiculous movie.
2 is outrageous
for a number of reasons. Like, that's like Cole Hauser being full Cole Hauser, and like there's like the scene with the rat where he puts the rat on Mark Boone Jr.'s like stomach. That's probably the most memorable scene outside of when they drive the car onto the boat. which is just in a like totally absurd setup. I think the movie just doesn't work quite as well in terms of pacing, and it just like is fully absurd without like being almost fun absurd at times. Three, I'm just like a sucker for high school movies. Like I like high school movies.
Sure.
Like that's kind of what it comes down to for me. The reason I have four ahead is I just think four is better from an action sequencing standpoint.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Okay.
It's better. It's still just trying to find its rhythm.
Yeah. So those are 8, 9, 10. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. The best one is still 5.
Strong agree.
Jump ahead.
Strong agree.
Best one's still 5. I think 5 is up there with Mission Impossible Fallout as two of the best action movies ever.
Yeah.
Ever.
The three best action movies of the decade, and it pains me not to put John Wick in this like three movie setup here. The three best action movies of the like 2010 to 2020 era were Fast Five, Mission Impossible Fallout, and Mad Max Fury Road. Like it's those three movies. Just straight.
I think that's fair. And then I would say Wick is close fourth. But yeah. So 5 is, I think, unimpeachable for most everybody. It is, I think, one of my favorite descriptions of it I saw last night from Kofi, your boy on Twitter, is he said it's like the action movie version of Ocean's 11 with cars, just bringing everybody together, heist movie, the pacing's incredible.
Yep.
You add The Rock, and it was just unbelievable. Unbelievable. So the safe chase is like my two favorite action sequences are the safe chase and the helicopter chase in Fallout.
Okay. Yeah. Those are good answers. Those are very good answers.
So good. So good. Anyway, I could do a whole podcast on Mission Impossible Fallout, by the way. So if you need one when this new one comes out,
maybe we'll do that. That's a good
talk. MI stuff. We can do that too. Okay, so 7th best. I'm gonna go. Oh, man, it's so hard. It's like picking kids.
So I'll tell you which one I have 7th best.
Okay.
I have Fate of the Furious 7th best.
I think I was debating 8. I think my next three are probably 8, 8, 1, and 7, maybe.
Oh, wow. So you really like this last movie.
This is where I get caught up in the moment. I had so much fun at the theater last night.
And it's great. It's a great movie.
It's so much fun. I can go with 8 there. I think it's 8, 1... And I guess, probably 9 or 7 in there.
Okay. So
1976 Hobbs. Okay.
So I have 7. I have 7 as the second best one. I think 7 is phenomenal. I think 7 is just so fun. Between the, like flying between the towers in Abu Dhabi.
Okay. I think I have 7 and 6 mixed up in my head.
Yeah, I think 6. So 6 is the one with Gina Carano.
Yeah. That's the plane one.
That's the never-ending plane one.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, I'm good with 8 there. I would say 1 would be 6th for me. It might be low for some people.
So you have 6th in 6th, I believe.
8, 6, 1. Yeah, so 7, 6, 5. Okay. Yeah. Man, I'm bad at this in my head.
So in 10th, you have 4.
6 is fine.
Yeah.
10th is 4, and then 2, 3, 8, 6, 1.
Yep.
Hobbs.
Yep.
7. Yeah, 7. When he says the street always wins and then he stomps and collapses a parking garage,
yeah,
I get chills every time.
7 is amazing. 7 is an unbelievable movie. It has Statham, like, full villain. It has The Rock. It's the one where
The Rock flexes out of the cast,
which is... The best unintentional funny scene in any of these movies.
Daddy's gotta go to work.
Yeah, and flexes out of the cast. It's the best...
And then he drives an ambulance through a drone, kicks out the windshield, double taps the drone, rips off the drone's machine gun, walks through the streets of LA, and eventually shoots down a helicopter with the drone machine gun.
It's the best. It's so good. And then Seven is also where Brian has to run on top of the bus falling off the cliff.
Yes.
Seven is unimpeachably good. Seven is like, it's close to me with Five. It's not quite as good as Five. I think it's very close, though.
I think that's sort of so. Because, like, I feel like they paid a little homage to that with the Jeep scene on the bridge in 9.
Yeah, yeah.
A little homage to the boy.
Yeah.
All time.
And then it's also the one where The Rock and Jason Statham have the fight in the DSS.
That's right.
Yeah, no, Seven is unimpeachable.
Six is the one with Ethan Shaw. They're in London. They have the little flippy cars.
And then Seven ends, like, with you crying, basically, because of Brian.
Yeah.
Like, that one's so good. Honestly, there's a real...
3 times in theaters, and I
cried each time. There's a real case that's the best Fast and Furious movie. I don't think it's close.
Considering the circumstances, I think it's so crazy how well they handle everything.
Yeah, I agree. Couldn't agree more. Okay, so you've got starting from 10, 4, okay. 3, 2, 8, 6.
Well, I've got 4, 2, 3. I have 4, 2, 3. I have 3 third.
Okay.
3 and 8, sorry. So 4, 2, 3, 8, 6.
Yep.
1.
Yep.
9. Hobbs, 7, 5.
Yeah, that's a good order. I like that order. I've got it. I'll start from the top.
I could also be talked into flipping 9 and Hobbs.
I think Hobbs is so good. Like, I don't understand why.
I need to go back and watch. I think I've only watched it a few times.
Yeah, I've watched it 2 or 3 times, and I think it's, like, hilarious every time. I've got it 5, 7 is, like, the two. They're, like, in a tier by themselves. If we're draft tiering Fast and Furious rankings, 5 and 7.
Those are the franchise cornerstone. Super.
They're the two. I've got 1 next.
Okay.
I've got...
I respect it. One's a great movie.
I've got 6 next because the highway chase scene where he catches Letty is amazing. And then
the chase scene is outrageous.
The longest runway in the world sequence on the plane is also amazing.
So good, and anybody that complained about it can go to hell.
Next, I've got Hobbs and Shaw. I've got Hobbs and Shaw. Which is the 9th movie. I think it's just fun. Like, it's a dumb movie that is super fun.
So fun.
I really also... We haven't talked about, like, the ramifications of Hobbs and Shaw. Because I really am wondering if, like... Like, what happens with that villain in Hobbs and Shaw? Like, does he team up with Charlize Theron in 10? Like, I wonder. Like, I think that's a really good idea. Is Charlize working for that guy? I don't know.
If you're trying to weave everything together...
Totally works.
There's a great way to pull it all together.
Yeah.
Just saying.
Then I have 9. So this one is a bottom half Fast and Furious movie, and I still really liked it for me.
Well, this is the thing. Like, for me, they are all delightful.
Yeah.
They are all good movies.
We come at this...
There are no bad movies.
We come at this from love.
Yes.
These movies are great.
But they are all on the, it's on FX, let's watch list.
Oh, totally. 100%. Then I have 8. 4, 3, 2 is where I'm at.
I think that's fair.
Yeah. I think people will yell at us for having Hobbs and Shaw as high as we do. I think people,
there are people who think Hobbs and Shaw didn't exist. They get mad that Shaw got brought into the whole thing as a good guy. But I was like, do you really expect them to bring Jason Statham into this and have him depart after one movie?
Yeah. It's so good.
I beg your pardon.
I don't care. I just want to have fun when I go to these movies. Yeah. And these movies are
people
very fun.
It's like, they're like, oh, he killed Han. And I'm like, guess what? He didn't.
Guess what? He didn't this time. Look at this.
Guess what? He didn't. We retconned that too. Fixed it.
Oh my god. Okay, last thing. Where do we want the Fast and Furious movies to go from here?
I think it's bring it all home, man. Bring it all together.
But do we want them, cuz like this one went bigger, right? This one went to space. Do we want them to continue going bigger, or do we want them to like have one where they like go smaller and do like
I don't think you
a
can
grittier action movie.
I don't think you can go smaller. If only because you have so many mouths to feed in terms of cast size that you can't go smaller. Like, I think the difference between this franchise and the Mission Impossible franchise, beyond the Mission Impossible franchise, like, only does things that Tom Cruise can, like, actually fucking do. Like, he's like, I'm going to learn to fly a helicopter to actually do this scene.
Right.
And it's like, you're an insane person, but okay.
Yeah, like, I'm not sure Tom Cruise can get the insurance to have him go into space.
He's tried, I'm pretty sure. I'm not kidding. I think he's working on it. Anyway, but yeah, like, it's also a smaller cast. You have, it's all about him and supplementary people.
Right.
And it's three supplementary people, right? It's Benji, it's Ving Rhames.
And it's Rebecca Ferguson.
Elsa. Yeah, it's Elsa. As opposed to this movie and franchise where you have Dom as the central character. It used to be Dom and Brian. And you have a dozen people that you got to get on there, especially if you bring back The Rock. And I think they have to stay big, but I think they do a good job with it in terms of, like, the nice thing is it's always car stuff. It's always them, like, in some kind of chase. And that gives everybody something to do. You know, like, I think they figured out the formula of how to have everybody doing what they have to do. And, like, okay, it's Dom who is always going to save the day. But how do we get to that point? And who is assisting him in getting to that point? And, yeah, I mean, like, it's one of those things where I'm like, I just want to see where they want to take it next. Like, I don't even have any sort of, like, concept of who I want to have added. Like, I did after 7, I wanted them to bring in Liam Neeson as the patriarch of the Shaw family. Because, like, who cares if he has the same accent? That'd be cool as hell. But then they brought in Helen Mirren as the matriarch of the Shaw family. I was like, even better, you know? And so I don't even want to tell them who to add, but, like, I feel at this point they can get whoever the fuck they want. Like,
oh, totally.
They got a Cardi B cameo just for shits and gigs in this one.
Yeah. You know? They can get anyone they want for these movies.
And so I just kind of want to see where they go. Like, I have full faith in Vin Diesel and Justin Lin, and you guys go make that sweet, sweet movie magic.
Yeah. That's where I'm at too. Robbie, tell the people where they can find your work.
Uprox.com, on Twitter at rcalland. We talk for a long time, as we always do, so it goes. Yeah, man, that's it. Uprox, Twitters, it's where I'm at, man.
Go follow Robbie. He is just the most fun person to talk about these movies with. This has been the Game Theory Podcast. Please remember, rate, review, subscribe, do everything you can to support the show. We'll be back next week with some NBA Draft Combine stuff. I'll do a recap with Matt Penny, and then some NBA playoff stuff. But until next time, we'll talk soon. Bye.